Let's Talk About is recorded and produced in Treaty 1 territories, on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Thank you very much for listening. So for this episode, I'm going to do something a little bit different. For once, I don't really need to go super into the facts of the case and the way things are presented and the way that we are looking at a certain issue and cutting through to the heart of, you know, what exactly has gone on. Because that's painfully clear, and every day we're getting more and more concerning and horrifying information. I still, like, those videos that first day at the Kabul airport, people, you know, breaking down fences and clinging to the sides of military aircraft as they took off, just desperate to get out from the situation they're in, is absolutely horrifying. As many of you know, on August 15th, Taliban fighters assumed control of the Afghan presidential palace, leading to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fleeing the country. I have no idea where he is. I don't know if anybody really does, aside from the U.S., but for the first time in 20 years, the Taliban are back in control of Afghanistan. And in the immediate aftermath, we have seen horrifying images, and people are terrified. Even before the Taliban fully seized control and started discussing what Afghanistan today in 2021 would look like under renewed Taliban rule, people were already preparing for the worst. They were already turning back the clock and reverting to life that they had a generation ago. Almost a generation ago. There are people born, there are adults in Afghanistan. There were young men in that group surrounding that airplane that have never lived in an Afghanistan that is under Taliban control. So, in the immediate aftermath, people were pulling down advertising. Women were burning their degrees and diplomas. People were changing the way that the clothes that they wore. News stations and radio stations went offline. People got rid of internet and books and really reverted back to the way Afghanistan was 20 years ago. When I first heard of Afghanistan, I was roughly 7 years old. I first heard of Afghanistan because of the war, because of 9/11, because of Canadian soldiers going over to fight there and support the United States. I am lucky enough to remember life before the War on Terror. And it's this weird forever war that we've been stuck in for so long that, to a degree, the fact that this happened didn't shock me, because this is what we have seen before. And I know a lot of people who grew up in the Vietnam era are just shaking their heads like, you should have known this was coming. You know, take what you will, say what you will about the occupation, say what you will about the war, say what you will about, you know, the policies of Dick Cheney and President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and U.S. politicians like Stephen Harper here in Canada. These wars and these occupations cost lives. They cost the lives of Western soldiers who went there under the belief that they were protecting their country and that they were doing something good. Obviously, there were some that went there to do bad. And there were Afghans and Afghan soldiers who fought and died thinking that they were preserving or protecting or saving the Afghanistan that they wanted to build. There were citizens and civilians that have died in droves in the past 20 years that many had nothing to do with the Taliban, nothing to do with the war. And it's easy, I think, for a lot of people. And I was one of them. You know, I was young. I grew up in, as I said, I was 7 years old the first time I heard about what Afghanistan was. And I grew up with consuming this stuff through headlines. And as I grew older, consuming it through media, like movies and video games. And it was easy for a lot of people to look at those first couple, in 2002, to say, oh, the Taliban are gone. You know, we quote-unquote won in Afghanistan. We beat the Taliban. But we didn't. We pushed them back into hiding. We, you know, we did what we did in Vietnam. We did what we did in really every war. When, you know, a war doesn't end until you have a peace agreement in place. And that simply didn't happen. We got close. We got to points where that negotiation was ongoing. But unlike every other past war that had an end, somebody kept pushing. Somebody said no and kept going. And it wasn't always the Taliban. It wasn't always the U.S. It wasn't always the Allied forces or the coalition forces, as they were called. It was a mix of the two. So we never were able to reach a consensus about the end of this war. You don't win a war by completely eradicating your enemy. You don't. It's easy to think that way, but especially when you're not fighting a state, you're fighting an idea. You can't really stop an idea with bullets. I remember in the early days of this show, I did an episode on mass shootings, and the way that, and I made allusions to, and I think at one point blatantly stated, that the way, the same processes that build a mass shooter, build a white nationalist, are what build terrorists. So white nationalists are terrorists often. It's this process of radicalization that is so apparent. And in the past couple of years, I've made great effort to study the war on terror, because I wanted to know what this thing was, this war with no end. And I think this is what people did during Vietnam. But Vietnam didn't stretch on for 20 years. you know, I've come of age throughout this whole thing, this whole conflict, and I've made a conscious effort to study what happened. I've read Permanent Record by Edward Snowden. I've read all of the Annie Jacobson books. I have consumed documentaries. I even watched Vice, the biopic about Dick Cheney. And you very quickly see that the way this war was fought was never about, or would never have led to a conclusion, a satisfying conclusion. And I think the image, the people placing the final shot, that famous photo of the fall of Saigon in Vietnam with the Huey helicopter sitting on top of a building while people desperately clamber up to it, juxtaposed again beside or placed adjacent to the image of a bunch of 30-something Afghans who were, many of them, children under the Taliban, clinging to the sides of Hercules aircraft as they were trying to take off. And it's the same thing, you know, those who do not know history are doomed to repeat themselves. And this was almost the only outcome. So there's a great article on The Conversation. It is by Ari Perlinger, who is the director of security studies and a professor of criminology and justice studies at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And it's entitled, Why Did a Military Superpower Fail in Afghanistan? And there are a couple, you know, there are two main points that he hits at. One being, and I think the one that we really have to level set with, is this idea that nation building is not a military strategy. And the best example we have of this is Vietnam. Because in Vietnam, you had this occupying force of Westerners, primarily Americans, who were there, well, basically only Americans, who were there to provide security, and in their purview or their perspective, to provide security to allow the democratic government of Vietnam, of South Vietnam, to build itself up and protect against encroachment of the North. And what you saw in Vietnam was, within that power structure that was put in place by the Americans, massive corruption. Because these, when you try and force this change, and you place these people in power, often you're placing people in power who do not deserve it. Even when there are elections, the weakness of the election rigor, as we saw in Afghanistan, is incredibly tenuous and difficult, and it led to corruption. Basically, everywhere, every instance where there has been an attempt to topple a government and then install one, that installed government inevitably fails or turns to something abusive. See it across South America, Latin America, a few European nations, obviously Vietnam, and now Afghanistan. Nation building is not a military strategy. Soldiers are not trained to build countries. Countries cannot be created out of whole cloth. They cannot be created by outside forces, outside people who do not understand the people of that nation. Afghanistan is a collection of ethnic groups and cultural groups that we in the West do not understand. So to put our own idea of democracy and governance on them, and to try and draw our own lines, really is drawing lines in the sand that would be blown away by time. You know, it's the problem when you draw something in sand, the wind will come away and sweep it. And that's really a problem that goes all the way back to the carving up of the Middle East. The countries that exist there are, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel, Jordan, these are countries that, by and large, did not exist. They may have existed in a progenital form, but they did not resemble the borders that we have drawn, because those people, ethnic Afghans, ethnic Iraqis, ethnic Iranians, didn't draw those lines. Because anybody who knows anything about Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, they know that those people in those countries are very diverse. They are culturally distinct from one another. They want different things. They see different things. And we kind of just drew lines around them and made them into boxes. I have a friend who's from Bangladesh, and Bangladesh went through a war and leading to Pakistan and Bangladesh separating from one another because there are distinct ethnic groups between the two that were kind of corralled together into one country. And it didn't work out very well. Led to war. You're seeing that in Kashmir, with I believe it's India, where you have this ethnic group that is so distinct and so different and is so far away from everything else that you can't effectively govern them under the same system. Russia is a great example of this because Russia is not just Russia. The whole eastern half of that country is a collection of small republics that have their own governments that fit kind of in this weird, similar to the United States, how the U.S. is a bunch of collected states that share one federal entity. It's similar in that way, but it's a bunch of amalgamated republics who self-govern on a regional level, on a republic level, but they're all part of the Russian Federation. It's a federation of different nations and states and republics. So with Afghanistan, we tried to go in, and I say the royal we, I say we as in Westerners, North Americans, went in and tried to apply our system of governance to this group we didn't understand and didn't care to understand. And we put that process in the hands of military leaders whose job is not to create governments. Their jobs are to provide security. Their jobs are to fight wars. Their jobs are to protect borders. So while they are being forced to build a country, they're also being tasked with training those soldiers that they don't understand and those ethnic groups that they don't understand, while also protecting them from the Taliban. The Taliban never went away. So to say we won the war against the Taliban is silly because we never finished that war. It was never over. We kind of pushed them to the hills and tried to build a country and then build an army so eventually we could leave and they could keep the war going while we're off, you know, back in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, or wherever you live. It was the first name that came to mind. So building that is hard, and it's even harder when you are actively churning. It's hard to build a country with an occupying force because you are constantly feeling, the people of Afghanistan are constantly feeling like they're at war and they're not safe and things are not over, so they cannot, and then you're putting corrupt governments in power. And it's doubly hard when you are actively turning those same people against you and in turn bolstering the enemy you supposedly defeated. So the second part of this article, I'll leave it in the show notes, Perlinger's article, is about the misuse of military power in counterterrorism. And I really look up the history of drone technology and the way that drones have been used, and were especially used during the Obama administration, because everybody, you know, points at George W. Bush and says, he was a warmonger. there were more drone strikes under Barack Obama than there were under George Bush. And I'm not sure about the final count, but I think Donald Trump might have just edged out and beat Obama. But Obama was over 8 years, whereas Donald Trump was over 4. And Donald Trump also dropped the mother of all bombs. So one of the main issues with this counterterrorism operation, I'm currently reading the book Blackwater about the Blackwater military company, which has some stunning revelations that in 2021 are shocking to me. But the main crux of the book on Blackwater is about how this private military force was operating unchecked, more or less, in Afghanistan, and was perpetrating violence that was actively turning... Oh, it was in Iraq, sorry. In Iraq, they were actively causing or perpetrating acts of violence in the furtherance of their mandate to protect and keep security of certain high-value individuals and, you know, American statespeople. And that was actively turning even the Iraqi government against them and making an untenable situation where they wanted these soldiers out. And it wasn't just that they wanted them out. It was actively turning young men and women against the Americans. The hatred of America is much less American values, the country itself, the people of America. When people are chanting death to America, they're really celebrating the Americans being gone and the danger of the Americans being gone. And I'm very sure if Canada was in that position, they'd be chanting the same. And a huge, huge part of this was the use of drone strikes, which were killing thousands of innocent civilians in the furtherance of this weird strategy. If you've ever heard the adage, you know, take the head off the snake, the body dies. That was the rationale used in counterterrorism, and it's used in fighting the drug war, the war on drugs, another war on an idea or a concept or a non-state actor that is very hard to stop. The idea was that you take the leadership out and everyone else will scatter. And they found, you know, with no leadership, the whole system will crumble and everyone will disperse and go back to normal lives. But when there's no normal life to go back to, when normal life is so awful for you, and when you have been radicalized to the point where you have this fanatical, ideological, deeply ingrained pull to keep going, it doesn't matter that your leader has died. What they found very quickly in counterterrorism operations, and something that we've known for a very long time because of the proxy wars in during the Cold War and all of the conflicts with drug cartels and the war on drugs, is that when you take out that leadership, it creates a power vacuum and somebody fills that spot. Somebody's going to come in to try and be the new leader, and that will either cause groups to splinter and create a bunch of different factions, or they will come in and try and prove themselves better ideologically, and that might mean they're more violent or they're more ardent in their beliefs or whatever, but it's never good. Very, very rarely do you have somebody come in that says that has the pull politically within a group to be the next leader that is not more ardently powerful. It's very rare to have a new leader come in and be supported in becoming to power who will then pivot the group to something different. If you killed an Afghan Taliban leader, it's very unlikely that the next guy up will suddenly say, hey, how about we pivot and respect women's rights and all of the things that the Americans helped build here in this country when we get back in power. It beggars belief, because that's not usually how group ideologies function in radicalized situations. Going back to that episode I did on mass shooters and radicalization, people are radicalized when they have no hope. When they are left with nothing, no opportunities, they lose their family, it is easy for a group to come in and promise them everything, especially promise them a family. If you think of the number of young Afghans who were orphaned by drone strikes, it wasn't the Americans coming and saying, hey, we're going to go take this for you. It was a village out in the middle of nowhere, a bomb, a drone strike happens, and suddenly a Taliban fighter comes and says, hey, we'll take care of you. Aren't you angry at the Americans? The Americans did this to you. And you're going to take this young, impressionable, emotionally distraught person who's just lost everything and promise them something. This is why we have people who seemingly have everything in North America and in Europe drop everything that they're doing to become an incel, to become a nationalist of some kind, to become a domestic terrorist, or become a supporter of terror overseas, because they do not have opportunities to live the life of the standard that society props up. They feel alone, they feel victimized, they feel isolated. And in many situations, society actively pushes them away. We actively look at these people who are different than us, that are strange to us, that are awkward and lonely and just different, and push them away. And that only makes the problem worse, because you're pushing them into the hands of people that want to use them for ill. With Afghanistan, with these drone strikes, we were pushing, and this occupation, we were pushing these young people and even older people in their 20s and 30s, we're pushing these people away and being the thing that's destabilizing their lives and pushing them towards something that they probably wouldn't have ever believed in. But because it gives them something, it gives them a future, it gives them a sense of camaraderie and understanding and family and purpose that had been stripped away. And it gives them a sense of security that had been stripped away by this occupation. And I don't want to sit here and say that the soldiers that went over are bad people. I don't think that. I like to see the best in people, and I like to think that soldiers that went over there did it with the best intentions. They did it because it's their job. They agreed to be a soldier. They got their orders to go to Afghanistan and do this job. And it was, it was the people in power that did this, that pushed people to do this. The adage, young men die to fight old men's wars. It was not the politicians. It was not Dick Cheney fighting this war. It was not Donald Rumsfeld fighting this war. It wasn't George Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump or Stephen Harper fighting this war. But they were the ones ordering it. So I'm not vilifying the people who went over and fought. I'm vilifying the people who sent them there in the first place. I know you had good intentions, but when you had the chance to stop this and find peace and just let it go, not just let it go, find a resolution that you could work with, sign a peace deal, sign a ceasefire, sign something that could allow these people to build themselves back up, you didn't take it. Thank you very much for listening. I'm going long again, but thank you very much for listening. If you're listening live on 101.5 UMFM, keep that dial on 101.5. You got great shows, great songs coming up right after this one. If you're listening on Spotify, thank you much for the download. And as always, have yourselves a wonderful, wonderful week.